Have you ever thought about like how even with like the fastest computers we have, sometimes they just hit a wall? When you start dealing with problems that get exponentially harder the more pieces you add, that's where things get really interesting, right? When we start thinking about completely different ways to calculate things.
Absolutely. Yeah. For some types of computation that are really intensive with traditional electronics, you start to hit a limit. You need to think differently about how to approach those problems. And that's where the idea of using light to compute is really appealing.
Yeah, optical computing using light instead of electricity.
Right.
It sounds futuristic,
Yeah.
but for certain kinds of problems, it has this big speed advantage.
Absolutely.
We're diving deep today into how one of these optical processors can tackle a problem that is really difficult for regular computers to solve.
And it's worth noting that these kinds of optical approaches are really well suited for problems that have a lot of parallel operations that you can do at the same time, and especially matrix calculations.
Yeah, the inherent nature of how light works
Yeah.
really allows for a lot of things to happen simultaneously.
Right. So we've got this research paper from the Journal of Optics, and it details a new optical processor.
Right.
Our mission today is to really understand how this processor is built, how it works, and how it can be used for a specific problem called the distance geometry problem, and particularly the one-dimensional version.
Okay, so let's start with the core of this optical processor.
Okay.
And at its heart, it's designed to perform matrix by vector multiplication.
Right.
And the key thing here is how it achieves this using light.
Yeah.
The main idea is manipulating the wavefront of a light beam.
Okay.
Think of a wavefront as the shape of a light beam as it travels.
Okay.
Okay, so how do you encode your input vector onto this light beam?
Yeah, the paper mentioned something about spatial light modulators,
Yeah.
SLMs, and polarization techniques.
Right, so it uses two of these spatial light modulators, SLMs.
Okay.
And these are essentially programmable optical devices that can control the properties of light.
So the process starts with a diagonally polarized light beam.
Okay.
You can think of light as a wave that vibrates in different directions.
Right.
Polarization is kind of like filtering that light
Uh-huh.
so that it vibrates primarily in a specific direction,
Okay.
in this case, diagonally.
Diagonally polarized light hits the first SLM,
Right.
and then what?
So the first SLM applies what's called a phase mask, and this is a pattern that's on the SLM,
Okay.
and it changes the phase of the light waves,
Uh-huh.
passing through different points of the SLM.
Okay.
And phase is really a measure of like the timing
Okay.
of those light waves.
Okay.
The crucial thing here is that this SLM mostly affects only one component of the polarization,
Okay.
the horizontal component in this setup.
Okay.
So by changing the phase of the horizontal part of the light wave differently across the beam, you create this difference in phase between the horizontal and the vertical polarization.
So the SLM is subtly shifting the timing of the light waves. How does that actually turn into something we can use for computation, though?
So that phase-modulated light then passes through what's called a half-wave plate,
Okay.
which is another optical element that further manipulates the polarization.
Okay.
Following that, you use a polarizing beam splitter, a PBS.
Okay.
And this PBS is like a filter,
Okay.
and it only allows diagonally polarized light to go through.
Okay.
So this combination of phase modulation by the SLM and then this polarization filtering
Right.
is a really clever way to take these subtle phase shifts
Yeah.
and turn them into changes in the intensity or brightness of the light beam.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, so the numerical values of your input vector are now encoded as this pattern of light intensity across the beam.
So it's almost like we're drawing the numbers with light intensity.
Yes, exactly.
That's really neat.
So yeah, it's a very elegant technique.
Right. So we have our vector represented as light intensity.
Right.
And then next up is the matrix multiplication step
Right.
using the second SLM.
Yes. So this light beam, now carrying the encoded input vector information, is directed onto the second SLM.
Okay.
This second SLM programmed with this pattern of gray levels,
Right.
and these gray levels correspond to the individual elements of your matrix.
Okay.
Before it hits the second SLM, the polarization is rotated back to diagonal.
Okay.
Then the same principle of this phase to amplitude modulation is used again.
Right.
So each point of light representing an element of your input vector
Yeah.
has its intensity modified according to the elements of your matrix.
So we have a light beam now
Yes.
whose intensity represents the product of the vector and the matrix elements.
Right.
But to actually get the output vector, we still need to add up
Right.
all those products
Yeah.
across each row of the matrix.
Right.
How does the optical setup do that summation?
So this is where you use a cylindrical lens.
Okay.
So unlike a regular lens that focuses light to a point, a cylindrical lens focuses the light in only one direction. And in this case, it's along the row direction of your matrix,
right,
as it's encoded on the second SLM.
This
focusing action effectively adds up or accumulates the light intensity contributions from each element within a row of the matrix onto a single point. In the output.
Right.
And the polarization is filtered again to just keep the horizontal component.
Okay.
And then the resulting pattern of light intensity now directly represents the elements of your output vector.
Okay, so we've done this whole process with light.
Yeah.
But how do we actually read those values?
Like, yes.
How do we go from a pattern of light intensity back to numbers?
Yeah, so the intensity of the light at different spatial locations in the output plane is directly proportional to the values of the elements in your output vector.
Right.
And this intensity pattern is then captured either by a CCD camera, which is just a digital sensor that records light.
Like in our phones.
Yeah, similar to the sensor in your phone.
Right.
Or an array of photodiodes. And by knowing how you mapped your input vector values to the light intensity, you can reverse that process and retrieve the numerical values from the measured light intensity.
Okay. So this whole process from input vector to output vector happens as fast as light travels through the system.
Right.
That's got to be really powerful in terms of computation speed.
Yeah. So that potential for high speed is a big draw here.
Yeah.
The fundamental multiplication and accumulation operations happen really on the order of nanoseconds for a single pass of light.
That's incredibly fast.
Yeah, and theoretically, one calculation could happen faster than you can even blink.
Yeah.
But of course, in the real world, the overall processing rate is also limited by how quickly you can update the patterns on the SLMs, their refresh rate.
Right. It's like having a really fast engine in a car.
Yeah.
But there's a traffic light every few feet.
Exactly. You're limited by that.
Right. The SLMs aren't instantaneous.
Right.
They need time to actually change their patterns.
Yeah. And the paper gives some examples of using commercially available SLMs.
Okay.
So, for example, if you have an SLM that has a resolution of around 920 by 1080 pixels and a refresh rate of about 50 hertz, you get a computing rate of about 0.24 gigahertz.
Okay.
And if you go up to more advanced commercially available SLMs with higher resolutions like 2464 by 4160 pixels.
Okay.
At 58 hertz, you could push that to about 1.2 gigahertz.
Still gigahertz. That's pretty fast.
Right. That's nothing to scoff at.
No. But they hinted at even faster speeds in the future, right?
Yes. So the refresh rates of current SLMs are definitely a bottleneck compared to that intrinsic speed of light.
Right.
But this is an area of active research and development.
Okay.
The paper mentions other optical computing schemes that use different approaches, like manipulating light in the time frequency domain, that have already achieved rates of 2 teramessies per second.
Okay.
They also point to advancements in solid state SLM technology with reported modulation rates as high as 5.4 megahertz.
Okay.
And if you could develop SLMs with refresh rates in the terahertz range, then this type of optical processor could reach those phenomenal speeds.
Right.
Additionally, the idea of using multiple SLM panels, all synchronized and working in parallel, is being explored as a way to increase the throughput by processing different parts of the matrix at the same time.
So it's interesting to think about where this fits in with other types of optical computing.
Yes.
And the paper does a good job of comparing this specific design to other things that are out there.
Yeah, it's important to understand the context.
Right.
So, for example, they mention an older scheme from 1986 that used spatial properties of light for computation.
Okay.
But it was really held back by the limitations of the SLM technology at the time.
Right.
It could handle matrices of around 100 by 100 in about 20 nanoseconds.
Okay.
For a single operation.
Okay.
But this new approach, even with today's SLMs, can handle much larger matrices, potentially exceeding 1,000 by 1,000 in a single pass.
Wow. Okay. What about more recent optical computing efforts?
Yeah, so there have been implementations that share a similar architecture.
Okay.
Using programmable devices to control the amplitude and phase of light.
Okay.
But some of those use what are called digital micromirror devices.
Okay.
And only a single SLM and the size of the matrices that they can handle. and their speeds are generally lower than the potential of this new processor.
Okay.
They also mention optical processors that are built on silicon chips.
Right.
And these currently achieve around 10 gigamexes per second.
Okay.
Which is faster than the current realization of this new design.
Okay.
However, the paper suggests that the path to further significant improvements in speed might not be as clear as it is for SLM-based approaches,
right,
given how quickly SLM technology is advancing.
Right. So it seems like this new design has a lot of potential.
Yeah.
Especially as SLMs continue to improve. Now let's talk about building one of these things.
Yeah.
Does it require like a super specialized lab?
So it's really interesting.
Yeah.
The paper emphasizes that the optical processor can be built with commercially available components.
Okay, that's good.
So we're talking about things like standard diode lasers.
Okay.
SLMs from companies like Holoeye and Thor Labs.
Right.
Regular optics like lenses and polarization filters.
Yeah.
And even just a standard computer to control the SLMs and read data from a CCD camera, which you can also get from companies like Thor Labs.
Okay.
The demands on that control computer are actually pretty minimal.
Okay.
It just needs to load patterns onto the SLMs and then process the output from the camera.
Okay.
The laser power requirements are also pretty low.
Okay.
Typically in the milliwatt range
for
a single processor, which you can get from common diode lasers.
So that's good. It means this isn't just some theoretical idea.
Yeah.
But are there any practical challenges with building and operating this type of system?
Yeah, so as with any kind of precision optical setup, maintaining the stability and quality of the laser beam is really important.
Right.
Things like diffraction, which is the spreading of light waves as they propagate, and fluctuations in the laser's intensity across the beam can introduce errors into the computation.
Ooh.
So using high-quality optical components and a stable laser are important for getting accurate results.
Okay, so we have a good picture of how this optical processor works.
Yeah.
For multiplying matrices and vectors.
Right.
With potentially really high speeds.
Yes.
Now, let's switch gears a bit and talk about the case study.
Okay.
This distance geometry problem in one dimension.
Okay.
What is that all about?
So the distance geometry problem, or DGP, in general, asks this fundamental question.
Okay.
Given a set of points and a list of known distances between some pairs of those points, can you actually arrange those points in space in a way that satisfies all the distances?
Okay.
So that space could be a line, a plane, or even 3D space.
Okay.
And you can represent those points and the distances between them as a weighted undirected graph.
Yeah.
Now, what makes this problem really challenging is that it's NP hard.
Oh, yeah.
Which means that as the number of points grows,
uh-huh,
the computation time needed to find a solution can grow exponentially with traditional computers, which makes it really difficult to solve for even moderately sized problems.
Okay.
Now, DGPs have important applications in areas like figuring out the 3D structure of molecules in structural biology and things like localizing sensors in networks.
Yeah.
But this specific paper focuses on the one-dimensional version.
Okay, so what kind of real-world scenarios does this 1D DGP apply to?
So one key application that they mention is the angular synchronization problem.
Okay.
Imagine you have a set of devices.
Okay.
And you want to figure out their relative angle based on measurements of the differences between some of those angles.
Okay.
So this problem actually has a connection to the problem of synchronizing clocks in distributed networks.
Okay.
Where the time differences measured between clocks are kind of analogous to the angle differences.
Got it.
In this ASP problem.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
The paper also mentioned these paradoxical instances of the 1D DGP.
Yes.
Specifically, when the points form a cycle, like a ring.
Right.
What's paradoxical about them?
So a cycle graph basically means each point is connected to exactly two other points,
right,
forming this closed loop.
Yeah.
What makes them paradoxical is that these 1D cycle graphs have a very limited number of solutions.
Okay.
Typically, only two possible arrangements of the points that satisfy the distance constraints.
Okay.
But if you remove a single connection, say between two adjacent points, the number of potential solutions explodes.
Oh.
It goes up to 2 to the power of n minus 1, where n is the number of points.
That's a huge jump.
It is. It's a huge jump.
Yeah.
And that's what makes them paradoxical.
Yeah. Just a small change in the problem,
yeah,
and suddenly there's this massive number of solutions.
Exactly.
So for these paradoxical 1D DGPs,
yeah,
the paper talks about using a branch and prune algorithm
right
as a starting point.
Right.
How does that work?
Yeah. So branch and prune, or BP,
Okay.
is a common way to solve these problems.
Okay.
It works by systematically looking at the positions of these points.
Okay.
So you start by fixing the first point, say at zero on the number line.
Okay, at the origin.
Yeah. And then for the next point, based on its distance to the first point,
Right.
there's usually two possible locations.
Plus or minus that distance.
Exactly.
Okay.
And this creates this kind of branching tree of arrangements.
Okay.
That's the branching part.
Right.
And the pruning part is where you use the other known distances
Yeah.
in the problem to cut off branches,
Okay.
which that don't make sense
Okay.
based on the information that you have.
Okay.
Now, for these paradoxical cycle graphs,
Right.
the important pruning often only happens at the very last point when you consider the distance between the first and the last point
Okay.
in the cycle.
Okay. And they mentioned this trick with a fictive vertex. How does that help?
So by adding an extra point,
Okay.
this imaginary fictive vertex,
Right.
and a new constraint,
Okay.
which is the distance between the first point and this fictive point,
Okay.
which you set equal to the distance between the first and the last point of the cycle,
Okay.
you can reformulate the problem in a different way.
Right.
So now a solution to the original problem
Yeah.
happens when the first vertex and this fictive vertex have the same position on the line.
Okay.
And this trick allows that pruning process to be used more uniformly.
Okay, so how do they turn this into a matrix and vector problem
Yeah.
that their processor can work with?
So the key idea here is to represent each possible arrangement of the points as this sequence of choices
Okay.
that you make in the branch and prune algorithm.
Right.
And you can represent those choices
Yeah.
as a Boolean vector,
Okay.
with each element being either negative one or one,
Okay.
corresponding to the two directions you can move
Okay.
to place the next point.
Okay, so plus one means move this way,
Yeah.
minus one means move that way,
Exactly.
and you multiply this vector
Yeah.
by another vector that represents the distances.
Right. So that realization vector is multiplied by a column vector y,
Okay.
which has the distance weights in it.
Okay.
And the result of that multiplication gives you the final position of that fictive vertex.
Oh.
And if the first vertex is at zero,
Right.
then a valid solution to the original problem exists only if the calculated position of that fictive vertex is also zero.
Okay, so to check all the different arrangements,
Right.
they use a matrix, right?
Yes. They construct a matrix M
Okay.
where each row represents one of those possible Boolean vectors
Okay.
of length N. Yeah.
Because we have in vertices, including the fictive one. So
Right.
that means M has N columns as well.
Yeah.
And the column vector Y, which has the distance weights, is just taken directly from the problem definition.
Okay.
And the paper gives you a formula to generate that matrix M efficiently
Right.
for an element Mij in row I and column J.
Okay.
The value is negative one.
Okay.
If I minus one divided by two to the power of J minus one modulo two is equal to zero
Okay.
and one otherwise.
Okay.
So this gives you a systematic way to create all possible combinations of negative ones and ones
Yeah.
for representing those branching possibilities.
So it's cool that this matrix is only negative one or one.
Yeah.
Does that make things easier for the optical processor?
Yeah, it simplifies things a lot
Okay.
because the matrix M only contains negative one and one.
Right.
You only need two different gray levels
Yep.
to represent that matrix on the second SLM.
Okay.
Similarly, the distance values in the vector Y need to be scaled to fit between zero and one,
Okay.
which the optical processor can handle.
Okay. Why is that scaling necessary?
So the scaling is necessary because you're manipulating light intensity
Okay.
with physical components,
Right.
and there are limits to that.
Yeah.
So in this case, the SLMs control how much light is transmitted,
Okay.
and they can only do that within certain limits.
Right.
The paper gives you the math for this mapping, but the important point is that the condition for the paradoxical DGP to have a solution
Right.
where the first and fictive vertex are the same
Right.
translates to a specific condition on the output vector R
Okay.
after doing that optical multiplication.
Okay. And because each element in that matrix M is defined independently,
Right.
this allows for the parallel processing with panels of SLMs.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's a big advantage here
Yeah.
because if you have multiple SLMs arranged in a panel,
Okay.
each SLM could encode a different part of that matrix M.
Okay.
And because they're all illuminated by the same incoming light,
Right.
they're all working together in sync.
Right.
So if that entire matrix M and
Okay.
the vector Y for a given problem
Right.
can fit within the SLM panel,
Okay.
then the optical processor can check all possible arrangements.
Wow.
At the same time.
Yeah.
As fast as a single flash of light.
That's incredible.
Yeah. So you completely bypass that exponential increase in time.
Yeah.
That a normal algorithm would face.
Yeah. So they give an estimate of what's possible right now.
Yes. So based on what's available with current SLM devices.
Okay.
The researchers think this optical approach could solve 1D DGPs.
Uh-huh.
With up to around 30 points.
Okay.
And as SLM technology keeps advancing,
right,
with faster refresh rates and higher resolutions,
yeah,
we can tackle even larger problems.
So to recap,
yeah,
we've seen how this optical processor,
right,
uses light and these spatial light modulators,
right,
to do matrix by vector multiplication, mm, really fast.
Yeah.
And how this can be used for this one-dimensional distance geometry problem.
Particularly the tricky ones with the cycle graphs.
Yes, those paradoxical instances.
Right. And it shows just how powerful optical computing can be.
Exactly. It really showcases the potential of optical computing.
Yeah.
To provide new and potentially far more efficient ways to address these challenges, yeah, that are just too difficult for traditional computers.
Right. So it makes you wonder, with all the progress happening with optical technologies,
yeah,
what other problems that seem impossible now,
yeah,
might become solvable with creative approaches that use the power of light.
It's definitely something to think about.
It is something to think about.
Yeah.
Very cool. Well, thanks for coming on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
It was great talking about this new optical processor.
Yeah, this was fun.
It's fascinating stuff.
It is.
And we'll have to keep an eye on this area of research.
Absolutely.
All right. Thanks again.
Thanks.
And everyone listening out there.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into the world of optical computing and the distance geometry problem.
It was a pleasure.
Until next time.
See you.